The next world war to be fought on water. As much as it might sound alarming and fictional, you hear this statement often in times in every relevant gathering of non-academic setting. I don't know if that might be the case. If it is, then there is no flashpoint than Central Asia to witness such a development. Glaciers, the main source of water for Amudarya and Sirdarya, the two rivers that makes up lifeline of Central Asia, is quickly declining. So does the water in these two rivers. Most part of the Aral Sea, once regarded fifth largest inland sea in the world, has disappeared. War of words become routine between neighbors Tajikistan, Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan in the recent period. So where the region is heading as their lifeline is quickly shrinking. Hello and welcome to the Majlis, a podcast talking Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and host of the show. Joining me to discuss the subject is a first ever guest of the show from Iran, Kaveh Madani, Senior Lecturer at the Imperial College in London, currently on a business trip to Iran. Kaveh, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Rizkildi Sadke, a Bishkek-based writer, his recent writings on melting glaciers in Central Asia was the source of inspiration for the show. Rizkildi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
As always, my colleague Bruce Panier is joining me here in the studio, who is our Central Asia specialist, also editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, our program has usually two parts. First, we do some reality check on the ground. Later, we continue debating possible consequences of the matter at hand to the region at large. First, reality check. I have been researching about this issue all weekend to polish my humble knowledge of the subject. Again and again, I came across with news about alarming level of melting glaciers in Central Asia, particularly in Kyrgyzstan, which is source of water for Sirdarya, in Tajikistan and Afghanistan, which provide a source of life for Amudarya. In according to some sources, those glaciers makes up nearly 40% of water for those rivers, and it might completely dry up by 2040. Mr. Sadke, as I said earlier, your writings on this subject prompted us to discuss the issue. Tell us, please, melting glaciers, is it an unprecedented situation, or it has been always the case and we never focused on this?
My understanding of the subject of climate change in Central Asia came about after I started researching Kumtor gold mine and the issues related to the glacier destruction at the site. But overall, I started meeting the scientists, especially the climatologists and the people who are deeply involved in the subject here in Kyrgyzstan and Central Asia. And the recent study, which was published by the German Research Center for Geosciences and the Swiss Federal Institute, they indicated that the Tian Shan Mountains in Central Asia lost 27% of the total mass over the last 50 years. And the study says that by the year 2050 and after that, the remaining ice of in the Tian Shan glaciers could be lost even further. So this is kind of a projection that the scientists have at the moment. And obviously there are many of the, you know, specifics that have the, you know, in the study. But overall, many scientists are saying that the climate change effect in Central Asia is developing in a much faster rate than ever before, and especially in the last two decades. So having said that, I was looking into the same issues per se in Amudarya and in Afghanistan, in the Wakhan corridor, and I found out that the studies which were done in the area, and especially in Hindu Kush and in the areas surrounding Pakistan, Afghanistan, the 93% of the glaciers there were retreating the same way. So, which says that Wakhan corridor is the tributary to the Amudarya River, one of the tributaries of the Aral Sea. And having said that, it looks like we have some challenging times ahead of us, and especially we're talking about several decades. But it is already known fact that the water flow in the tributaries of the Amudarya River in the Wakhan corridor already decreased. So, which means that we already are witnessing the climate change effect in Central Asia. And as far as the signs of climate change in Kyrgyzstan or in Kazakhstan or other states, neighboring states, I think we saw it this year when the temperatures hit their record high, and we saw some of the flooding situations here in Kazakhstan and in Kyrgyzstan. And the melting of glaciers were, I think, on the spot. And even Professor Holzel from Switzerland, he is running the Katkos project in Central Asia. They were telling me that they were amazed by the rates of the rapid melt within the glaciers here in Kyrgyzstan. So I think it's a bigger fact, and the government should be dealing with this preferably as soon as possible, but we do realize that here in Central Asia, it's not that easy to do so.
Right. Kawa, you are researching similar subject in Iran, but you are aware of what's happening in Central Asia in this case. Can we relate all of this change only to a climate change?
That's an interesting and very controversial question, I would say. If you're talking about the current situation and what we're seeing in the region, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in California, in different places, we always have this debate whether this is climate-related or the product of a lot of years of mismanagement and anthropogenic changes. I strongly believe, and I think most researchers who have studied the subject closely, believe that this issue, I mean, in short, on what we are seeing at the moment is the product of mismanagement, and we're talking about decades of mismanagement. Central Asia is very similar to Middle East, is very similar to Iran. We are not really dealing with the water shortage issue, in truth. We are talking about, so for example, comparing Iran and Central Asia, both of these places, these regions are not that bad in terms of water availability, if we're talking about water availability per capita. What the issue, though, is that we have had, we planned in the wrong way, have made this these countries, I mean, the first industry in these countries is agriculture. So where you want to irrigate, you have water shortage problem. Wherever you irrigate, you have water conflicts. Wherever you irrigate, eventually you face water shortage. And this is what we're seeing. If we look at the past, what has happened, for example, in Iran, we don't see a significant decline in terms of precipitation. Of course, we see some increase in temperature. Similarly, in other parts, I mean, I have done a lot in California as well. California, there's a big debate. Similar thing is there. We have climate variability. We don't know exactly whether this is the product of climate change or is this going to last forever. But we know that at the moment things are not as good as before. We have droughts in many places. We also look into climate models and the future and projections. Of course, projections are scary in most places in the world. But, you know, right now, the problem is so acute that climate change doesn't worry, you know, me much. I think we have to do a lot of other things at the moment immediately if we want these countries to survive till 2050 to see the climate change effects.
Right. Besides climate change, Kawa, you also mentioned the mismanagement of the water. Bruce, you are following the water situation in Central Asia. What kind of examples we have in terms of mismanagement of water in the region?
Ultimately, I think you would have to say the greatest example of mismanagement of water in Central Asia is simply the dependence on the cotton crop. You know, years ago, I had professors when I was in grad school the one professor put it the best of anybody. He said, cotton is a thirsty crop. You know, now there was some indigenous cotton in Central Asia, but it certainly wasn't grown on the scale that it's grown today. And so you have a lot of this, you have a lot of water usage going to this one crop, which brings in a lot of money for the local governments, but you know, the same professor that said it was a thirsty crop also said cotton is a poor man's crop. There are no rich states who became rich from selling cotton. So Central Asia really needs to rethink some of its priorities. If the priority should be to make sure there's enough food for people to eat. If that's the priority, then they probably would be okay shifting the water over and using it for agricultural purposes, which would lead to food sources for the people. But as long as they have this dependence on the cotton crop, they're using water, you know, for something that's really, I mean, it brings in a lot of money for the governments in fast cash, but But in terms of how much you could make from other products and stuff, you know, again, cotton is just not a big money-making crop, but the region's just become dependent on it in the last 150 years.
Right. Riskildi, you are welcome to add if you have anything to add what has been discussed in the panel. But my question was, yes, we understand the climate change is affecting on a level of water that Amu in Sirdarya gets from glaciers. And also we discussed about the mismanagement of what is already available in those rivers. Do we have any technical measurement to explain the level of decline of waters in those rivers?
You see, that's the thing. Here in Central Asia, it depends on from state to state. What you just mentioned about the data, about the technical details, specifics. And Professor Holzel, who manages one of the COTCO projects here in Central Asia, he was telling me that here in Kyrgyzstan, it's a bit better. And this project is especially is going well in this country, in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan to some degree. But in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, there's not much going on at this point. But they hope that they could do more groundwork in those states. But the same thing I heard from Professor Ben Arlo from Columbia University. He was telling me that these measurements, the water measurements, they've been done in the past, and especially during the Soviet times. But after the 90s, when the Soviet state collapsed, mm-hmm. for about close to two decades, maybe 15 years, there were no activities of research activities taking place because of the political economic situation and all that. But during the after 2010, I believe the situation is improving a little. Right now, it's a bit better. Number of projects have been taking place here in Central Asia, especially in Kyrgyzstan. COTCOS is one of them. Hmm. And another one is the University of Central Asia. They have a number of scientists on the board of directors of that university. And moreover, you know, it all says that the communication has jump-started again. It is a positive sign in terms of research. But you have to understand that this climate change subject is a complex subject. It's not just we're talking about the ground measures. It's obviously we're talking about the satellite data. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a global picture, what's happening here, what's happening in South America or in Greenland or in North Pole. So this is all combined analysis. But what's happening here in Central Asia, and I think that study that I was just talking about, it just proved that Central Asia is on the verge of the greater challenges in the decades ahead. But another thing about the mismanagement, which is totally correct, and Bruce just mentioned the Uzbekistan, that's another thing, because Aral Sea is a totally man-made disaster, totally man-made. But we can't say that the Aral Sea was made because of the climate change. But even then, if the climate change is it's a slower force, which means it progresses steadily here in the region. By that, I mean that within 50, 100 years, we should start seeing some of these effects on the ground. And I think, according to Professor Holzel, he was telling me that some of these areas in the Fergana Valley are already experiencing a water shortage already, which is a small number. But according to him, the Central Asian governments will be forced to cooperate when they'll be confronting climate change effects down the road.
Right. Kaveh, I know you have been researching a similar situation in Urumiya Lake in northern Iran, which has also seen sharp decline in water. What comparison you can draw between what you see there and also what's happening in Central Asia?
Believe it or not, actually, we in a recent study which was published in the Journal of Great Lakes, we believe strongly that what we are seeing in the Lake Urumiya case, which is also one of the largest salt lakes in the world, was the Aral Sea syndrome. So the syndrome is spreading in the world. Urumiya Lake is not the only victim. We're seeing the effect in many, many places. Aral Sea is probably the classic example of mismanagement, a man-made disaster. We're seeing this elsewhere. The problem is that we have been in the developing world, we have been in the hydraulic, we're still in the hydraulic mission era. The West has already passed that stage. In the hydraulic mission area, most of the solutions are engineering solutions. Governments and engineers and experts get excited, and even citizens get excited about infrastructure, concrete dams and different sort of water transfer structures and things like that, because they're symbols of development, they're symbols of, a pride for a nation which can prove to the world that they're good, they can do things on their own, they can build things, and, people always appreciate infrastructure at the first place. And at the beginning, you always try to manage the water, move water from one location to another, manage the timing of water use, and so on. And as time passes, through decades, when you tease the nature, when you damage the nature would react in some way, and then we see the effect. So when you divert water, it's an easy mass balance. The lakes don't get enough water input, and evaporation is high, and then you lose the lake gradually. So in case of Lake Urumia, we also see a decline. 90% of the lake is gone, and now the nation is recognizing this. Tragedy as a national tragedy. Everyone is trying to do something, but it's really hard, because when you have the infrastructure in place, when people are doing their business, when they're farming, you cannot really misplace people, you cannot move them, you cannot give them other alternative jobs in the short run, you cannot even make them grow alternative crops. The same situation has happened in Central Asia, and it's unfortunate that we never learned from these things, because similar things had happened in the past in the West. I mean, California or West United States, also a lot of problems of this kind, but we never learned. China is building a lot of dams. Iran is building a lot of dams. Central Asia is building dams. And we still see the similar situations. And the situation is going to get exacerbated as we go forward, because we still, in many of these places, do not recognize the cause. We say mismanagement. It's easy to say mismanagement, but it's not only mismanagement in the water sector. When you're talking about development plans, when you're talking about land use management practices, when you talk about population growth and where this population lives, where you have migrations, urbanization, and so many factors that just complicate the problem, and it's really, really hard to address the situation. And unfortunately, things get worse and worse. On the positive side, when we are under pressure, we sometimes act better. We increase the efficiency of our use, but the rate of response, or the speed of response to crisis, is not fast enough. So we have people suffering, we have people dying, we have a lot of conflicts going on, we have people who use fire to get water and protect their lives and farming businesses. I mean, it's a sad situation.
All right. The effect of the entire water crisis is already pretty bad in Central Asia, as all we agree. It cannot be more evident than shrinking water in Aral Sea. Rizkel, Kawa, both of you mentioned this. So where else we see that it is already having direct impact on day-to-day life of the ordinary people in Central Asia? Bruce, you want to jump in?
Well, certainly, we mentioned, Riskildi mentioned the Fergana Valley at the start, and that's really, that's the potential flashpoint for all these water problems. Anyway, now we've already seen this, especially on the Kyrgyz-Tajik border. I've been down to that part of the world, and in fact, I'm going to be down there again next week. This is a classic, like, oases kind of area, where there's barren rock and sand, but every now and then you find a place where agriculture is possible. And this has been contested ground in Central Asia recently. Right along the Kyrgyz-Tajik border, there have been instances, where people feel that their water right has been violated by one community deciding that they would take extra and blocking off a neighboring community from getting the water. This is a very small example of what could happen, but one can easily foresee a similar situation taking on the same kind of aspect between states rather than between two isolated communities in this one place. So it is a big issue, and we've seen that people are willing to fight for it already, and we've had dozens of people injured and hundreds of people come out to join these fights. And if the situation keeps going like it is, remembering that the population of Central Asia has increased dramatically in the last 100 years, you're going to end up with a lot of these conflicts, because you might have oil, you might have gas, you might have gold, whatever. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you don't have water, you don't have anything.
Right. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for your insight. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will be talking about what does the current developments means for security and stability of Central Asia. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Majlis. In this episode of Majlis, the weekly podcast talking Central Asia, we are discussing about an impending water crisis in the region. Joining me on the phone is Kawa Madani, a lecturer at the Imperial College of London, who is currently in Iran. Rizkeldi Sadka, a Bishkek-based writer and journalist, and in the studio, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlag Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to participate in the show. Now, over the past 15 minutes or so, I have referred to the situation as an impending water crisis in Central Asia. I hope I'm not exaggerating that situation, Rizkeldi.
Well, that's a controversial subject by itself, the water crisis. You see, many speculate that there could be a water conflict in Central Asia, right, which was the subject of my discussion with Professor Arlov about a couple of months ago. And he was telling me a very interesting a study on Syria, because they do have the same issues there as well with the water issues. Obviously, they have Turkey, and they have Iraq, they have Syria, and Turks built water dams in the upstream of the Tigris and Euphrates. But nonetheless, it's not what they are fighting for. It's not over the water. The conflict there popped up because of the social and political issues, not the water issues. So I was referring to this similar scenario could be developed in the Fergana Valley. Bruce was referring to the conflict on the border over the water rights. But Professor Arlov was telling me that it's not likely that the conflict would take place in such a matter or in such scenario, because there are not many cases where states were fighting for over water. So most likely the case, as Professor Arlov was telling me, would take place in the internally within the state, which means that probably when the water crisis hits the Fergana Valley, for instance, most likely the scenario is there will be a displacement of mass amounts of people in the state, within the state, which means that if there is a scenario where thousands or hundreds of thousands of people will be moved from the areas hit by the drought, or let's say a water shortage, that would mean that the people would move to the cities. And that's the paper, a recent paper came out on Syria, which claims that the climate change was part of the conflict in Syria because of the serious droughts, which took place from 2006 to 2010. And right around that time, 1.5 million of people moved to the cities in Syria, which caused internal tensions and social tensions. And we all know what happened after that. So probably, according to Ben Arlov, and I'm just quoting him, in the Fergana Valley, that would most likely be the case, the scenario, where the movements of people and migration, internal migration, would cause some instability. That's the kind of scenario that some scientists believe they believe would take place. But as far as the bigger subject of the instability in the region in Central Asia, I think the upstream states, they'll be dealing with the issues on how to distribute the water distribution system of the I guess the water management. And the downstream states, I think, according to projections, the downstream states, especially Uzbekistan and areas around Aral Sea, will be hit very hard with the water shortage issues. And from then on, I guess all kinds of scenarios are possible.
Yeah, Rizkeldi, I see there is one challenge emerging in terms of the distribution of water in the upstream countries, but I will get back to that in a minute. But first, Bruce, let's go into the scenario of conflict that you mentioned in the first half of the show. I know water is already one of the main sources of tension between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. How far we are from an actual confrontation in this?
That's going to depend a lot on who you ask. Uzbek President Islam Karimov was the one who said just a few years ago that he believes that water would be the source of a future conflict in Central Asia. We know that Uzbekistan they've been extremely opposed to ideas of building these large hydropower projects in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. They say it's going to leave them dry for a sustained period of time while they're filling the reservoirs, and they've come out against these even after both Uzbekistan and Tajikistan suggested that the World Bank conduct a feasibility study of the Rogun Dam. And when the World Bank said that they could be built and it didn't represent a problem, Uzbekistan just dismissed the findings of the World Bank immediately and fell back on the same old argument that this was going to deplete water from their fields. They weren't going to have the same kind of agricultural outputs. Just a little bit further away, we also have to remember that mixed into the scenario is the fact that most of the oil and gas in Central Asia is in the western part, the part that's dry already. And so if you have less water coming out of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, as Rizkeldi noted, the places that are going to be affected first and most severely are going to be the places where the water, where the gas and oil are being developed. So you're going to have a real problem with these governments trying to figure out what's the priority for them, because they really think near term. I mean, none of these governments are thinking, 100 years down the road. So they're going to be upset with the fact that they don't have enough water to supply that part of the population that is now engaged in getting gas and oil out of the ground in the western parts of the countries. So you can foresee where some of the bigger states, I'm afraid, will put the pressure, such whatever pressure they feel is necessary, on the smaller states, which are Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, to get them to release more water into the system. And, we know that Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan said several times that they're not financially capable of maintaining the water systems, the supply, the locks, the dams, the things like, all that stuff, and keeping the water flowing without more money, which the other countries are reluctant to give them at the same time. So, I can see where this is going to be a problem in the future. It depends on how it's managed, but with the population in Central Asia growing, and that's something I probably should have mentioned a while ago, but Tsarist censuses at the start of the 20th century showed there was only 6, maybe 8 million people living in Central Asia, and the population is 66 million now, and it's going up. So it can't be that much longer before, even with well-managed water systems, you're going to have to figure out how to ration this wisely so that everyone gets some.
Yeah. In connection to that, Bruce, actually you reminded me one of my own piece on that subject, which I did several years ago for an academic institution, in which I tried to explain why the crisis said to get only worse, simply because there is a new actor in the field, and the name of that actor is Afghanistan. While doing that piece, I could not find any information about any recent water-sharing agreement between Afghanistan and those Central Asian countries, and the last agreement was signed between Afghanistan and Soviet time years ago. And as you know, Soviet Union does not exist anymore. So this is an issue because so far, due to domestic conflict, Afghanistan wasn't able to use the share that it is entitled to use. But as situation develops there, Afghanistan is an agriculture-based society country. They will be using more and more water from Amu River, at least. So even though Afghanistan is not using what it's supposed to use, Central Asians are engaged in a kind of a war of words, to say least. Even beyond war of words, when you see Uzbekistan is stopping the trains heading to Tajikistan, it is actually a step further than war of words that's taking place between these two countries because of Tajikistan's Dame project, Bruce, you just mentioned. So where we are heading in this, how you look into the entire region from a different perspective, we are very much focused on Central Asia. So where we are heading?
I just want to comment a little bit on the war issue and conflict before answering directly what you ask. I want to echo something that we have never had in the history. We have never had two nations fighting only over water or you know, uniting only over water. But water has always been a good excuse for going on a war. It has been a good weapon to threaten the neighbors, and will continue to function like that. And as the population grows, as our demand is increasing, this functionality becomes more precious, and you know, we see it more. So we will see conflict. Now, you know, studies which I think, you know, suggest that climate change is the cause of a war or a conflict or Arab Spring or, you know, the formation of ISIS, I don't think those are, like, very honest or accurate studies. But it is true that when we have a drought, when we have pressure on the agriculture, when people go out of, farmers go out of business, when, you know, they cannot farm anymore, when they migrate, we have a social issue. We have a social crisis. Mm. We have a bunch of unhappy people who are not as wealthy as before, and which who are suffering from a bad economic condition. Yes, they have an incentive to join ISIS and fight, and they have an incentive to grab their guns and shoot people. It's not directly because of water, but this situation will be there. And as we go forward, if you don't plan well, this becomes a very important security problem for the governments running the nations, and that's why they're paying a lot of attention to the issue. As I said before, the issue we have right now in Central Asia, even some parts of Middle East, is not the issue of water shortage in terms of, like, water availability. We have what we call economic water shortage, meaning that our population do not have access to clean water. Of course, Iran is probably the best in the region, but if you look at the neighbor, Afghanistan is probably has the lowest rate in the world when it comes to access to clean water in rural areas, for instance. This situation is not going to be changed in the short run unless the government have top priorities to address the issue. But now, look at who the governments are. And if you look at the governments in the region, these governments have a lot of problems to deal with. The political instability is there. Economic instability is there. So their top priority would not be water, I don't think. I mean, I want to be a pessimist here and say that in the short term, unfortunately, we would not see significant changes. What the governments would do is just to manage the situation so it's a crisis management. We just, you know, if for example, in case of Lake Rumia that you mentioned in Iran, when the pressure is high on the government, when some people are unhappy, it becomes a political issue, you release some water to the lake, the situation gets better, you see a rain and things like that, then people will be silent, business continues as before. And unfortunately, we have the situation there. Upstream countries upstream countries would increase the pressure on the downstream countries and would ask for things in return. This has happened in, you know, the case of Tigris and Euphrates, as the other guest mentioned. So Turkey is increasing its use. It has happened in case of the Nile, when now, due to instability in Egypt, Ethiopia got a good chance of increasing its water withdrawal capacity, and it's happening in the rest of the world. The conflicts would increase. We will not see a war, but we see a lot of social disasters, and we might see a war which is not directly because of water, but it has happened, you know, can be affected indirectly by water shortage. This situation in the region is really bad. We have a food crisis, water crisis, energy crisis together, and if we consider these three together, we would have a real human crisis in this region.
Right. We are just getting out of time, but I like to mention one thing that you said, Kaveh, here. You spoke about this solution and willingness of the authorities in the region. In fact, you know, there are signs that developments are taking place in opposite direction to solution. To give a concrete example here, the Turkmenistan is building a huge artificial lake in the middle of the Karakum Desert, and obviously it has to be filled with water, and this water cannot come from anywhere other than Amu River. So yes, the solution is important, but the directions, the sign seems it's going opposite to solution. But since we started talking about solution and we are getting out of time, let's say a few points here about the solution. Bruce, what's the outcome in this very dramatic scenario?
If there was more rational use of the water and certainly more cooperation regionally, to reach that goal, then I suppose it would help a little bit. You know, Riskeldy would know more about the glacier reduction than I would, and you know, and that's something that you can't fix very quickly. But in the meantime, if you could just get some agreement on you know, the allotments of water, realistic agreements, you know, what it's going to take to feed your population or to keep your population with enough water, not only for their own personal use, but for agricultural use, and not exceed that. And you know, again, switch from that horrid cotton crop to something that's more beneficial to human beings, then that would at least be a good start.
Right. You know, the solution also requires the leaders coming together, meeting, talking to each other about the issue. Is that the possibility, Riskeldy, that Central Asian leaders could come together and easily talk about the solutions?
Well, that's what I ask many scientists here in Kyrgyzstan. But thing is that I'm pessimistic too as a guest in Iran. I'm not that positive on that because of the nature of the regimes here in Central Asia. And moreover, in the last 20 years, we haven't seen much of the progress with cooperation between the states here in Central Asia. And if you don't have a cooperation, then how would you fix urgent issues such as adaptive capacity to the scenarios, disaster scenarios? And to do so, you're going to have a communication, and it's not just communication, but effective communication.
Right.
And if you don't have that, I don't believe we have anything positive to stay on at the moment. But as I said, this is we're looking at the decades, several decades, even 100 years ahead of us. And hopefully within the next decade or two, maybe we'll have new governments who would be able to take the issue and do something about it. But at the moment, it's not much.
Right. I would conclude the debate unless, Kawa, you have something to add here.
Just to be positive, history shows that the cases of cooperation over water have, you know, been more than cases of conflict. So we can be hopeful that things like, you know, cooperative mechanisms emerge in the area. Another fortunate thing is that statistically cooperation is not correlated with the nature of government, whether they're a Democrat or dictatorship and so on. So would not necessarily affect the status of cooperation. But I also want to add that, you know, cooperation mechanism is an ideal solution. Of course, we have to think about possible trade because upstream nations have to get something in return for it, for their cooperation and willingness to release water. So that's something to work on. What possible alternatives are there for trade between these nations? Out of the water context, you can give food, energy support, and, you know, economic help and so on. But the other thing is that, you know, that's an external thing and it's an ideal thing. These nations need to work on reforms within their countries to be able to cope with water shortages to climate change later on, or their neighbors taking out the water out of the rivers. Agricultural reforms are the most critical solutions at the moment. Industrialization and moving gradually from agricultural-based economy to industrial or energy-based economy is necessary for these countries because they have to understand that they cannot irrigate forever.
Here you go. Thank you very much for your insight, Kawa Medeni, lecturer at the Imperial College London. Also, thank you, Riskeldy Sathka, a Bishkek-based journalist, and my colleague Bruce Panier here in the studio for your participation in the show. As always, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Dear listeners, you have been listening to the Majlis, the weekly podcast talking Central Asia. Thank you for your time for tuning in to the debate. As always, we welcome any suggestion, comments about the show, the topic discussed in the show, and your reaction to the opinions expressed during the debate. You can get in touch with us via rfyarl.org. You can leave your comments on facebook.com/rferl. You can follow us on twitter.com/rferl. That's it for this show from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the weekly Majlis, and entire team in Prague. Thank you for listening to the show. Bye-bye.